Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Simon Winchester has taken on subjects as diverse as the volcanic explosion of Krakatoa to the creation of the Oxford English Dictionary. His latest book, The Perfectionists, traces the development of technology from the industrial age to the digital age to explore the single component crucial to advancement, precision. Again, the name of the new book is The Perfectionists, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Simon Winchester to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being here.
Lovely to be here, as always.
Given the subjects that you have tackled over your incredible career, at what point do you think of something like perfection as a subject, as something that you can actually sink your teeth in and work on?
Well, the thing about this book is that it was done at the suggestion of a reader. I mean, I get letters from readers all the time saying, you know, my great-grandmother fought in the Second Afghan War, and would you write a book about her? And I would usually say, well, jolly interesting, but I just don't think many people are going to buy it. Right. But then this fellow last, it must have been about 7 years ago now, he was called Colin Povey, and I'd never heard of him. He was a complete stranger, but he was a reader writing from Florida. And he said, I've read all your books and I've liked them, which is a very nice thing for anyone to say and for me to hear. And he said, I've often thought that someone, and I think you'd be the ideal person to do it, should write a book about precision, because it's terribly important to the way we live our lives. And yet it's invisible, rather like the air we breathe or the language we speak. And what about it? And I thought, because my father was a precision engineer, and I had a very long and rather curious relationship with Rolls-Royce Motors because of a big journalistic story I did in the 1980s that involved driving a Rolls-Royce, essentially, through the Soviet Union. And I thought, he's right. There's a book here. So I put it to my editor at Harper, and he thought, yes, but what's the narrative thrust of the book? What's the through line, as they say in Hollywood? And that foxed me for a while. I wasn't quite sure. And what we didn't want, and I think generally is a bad thing in books, is to do a sort of pointillist portrait, episodic. It needed to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. I mean, it's rather corny, but it does. And once I got stuck in to do some research, and this, I suppose I began the research about four or five years ago, in other words, a couple of years after Mr. Povey wrote to me, then I suddenly, there was a sort of an epiphany, and I realized what the structure of the book would be. But at first I was dubious, but then it came to me in a sudden moment.
So we'll talk about that in a moment. But what's this idea of precision, this idea of perfection, is elusive, right? Because that can happen at any given time. It cannot happen at any given time. And you know it when it happens. You know it when it doesn't happen. But why it didn't happen that time and happened the last time is what can make your brain hurt.
Yes, it can make your little dots of blood in your forehead when you're trying to think it out.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, this book in England, the original title, my wife's title actually, is the word exactly. And so it's in England and Australia and New Zealand, where it's actually doing very well. It's exactly how precision engineers created the modern world. But the American publishers, love them obviously as I do, I've been with them now for 25 years, they said selling the idea of a concept, which is what exactly is to them, it's not to me, exactly is simply a... it's not exactly conceptual. We prefer to sell books with a title that has got people in it, humankind. So can you come up with a human version of the word exactly? And so I thought about it for the weekend and came up with this title, The Perfectionists. And they said, terrific. But within about, I should think, 20 minutes of them saying that, I started to get emails from people saying, but we hate perfectionists. Perfectionists are nitpicking, pedantic fuss budgets.
Yes. Anxious, fussy, worried exactly. about everything.
Yeah, exactly. So, but mercifully, this book has done well, and it's on the New York Times list, and I'm here with you, so clearly hasn't put you off too much. But it was an anxious moment for me, and exactly as doing exactly as we expected.
Because exactly does indeed have some dual meanings, doesn't it? And allows some, I would think, for you as an author, some wiggle room as yes. to you explain what's going on.
I do need to explain one thing, though, early on, because this whole sort of semantic discussion leads me into the whole definition of precision
yes.
and accuracy, and they're two very different animals. I am lazy, and like most people, use the words more or less interchangeably, but there are no synonyms in the English language, and those two words mean something very different, and to engineers the difference is important. Accuracy, and the best way to illustrate this is to think of a dartboard or a target. If you fire something at it, a gun or an arrow or a dart, your intention is to hit the bull, to hit the middle. And if you do, in other words, if you have achieved what your intention is, you have achieved great accuracy. If, however, you fire the bullet or whatever it is, and it hits, let's say, 10 o'clock, but does so again and again and again and again, you are throwing your dart with great precision. So precision is the replicability, if you like, doing the same thing. And this applies in engineering. There's a very important aspect of this. And that's the making of interchangeable parts, where every part you make is exactly the same over and over and over again. That's precision. Achieving your intention is accuracy. Achieving what you want time and time and time and time again is precision. And those two things are rather different.
So you tell the story of these unsung engineers who work for this precision, and you show us the evolution of precision, which, as you point out, is a major driver, the major driver of what we experience as modern life.
Yes, and in fact, the modern life began with the birth of precision on a very specific and now recognized date. 1776, important year for the United States, yes. of course, but not in this case. July the 4th, May the 4th. That's when the first truly precise thing was A, made, and B, turned into a working machine. By doing so, began the Industrial Revolution. So everything changed. Interestingly, I didn't realize this, and perhaps you do, Joe, but do you know the significance of May the 4th? Well, it's Star Wars Day.
Yeah, oh, that's right. May
the 4th be with you.
That's right.
I have no idea.
Yes.
I just think it's wonderfully appropriate that precision was born on May the 4th, on Star Wars Day.
Very true. Now, one of the things that is so fascinating about that date, of giving precision a birth date, is that it lops off centuries before, where we could go back to the Greeks and think, oh, well, this had to have been precise in its own way.
Well, yes and no. I mean, people say to me, well, what about the pyramids? You know, the stones are so perfectly put together, you can't slide a sheet of paper between the two of them. That's actually not true. I don't know whether you've walked up the pyramids, but the stones are not precise at all.
Right.
I mean, they're not like pieces of metal which slide brilliantly together. Similarly, I mean, the earliest precise-looking thing, but it's not precise, is an extraordinary piece of clockwork-like mechanism, which was called the Antikythera mechanism, which was hauled up from the Aegean by some sponge divers at the early part of the last century. An amazing confection about the size of a telephone box, full of gear wheels, hand-cut bronze gear wheels, and you turn a lever and basically little handles predict the position of the sun and the stars and the then five recognized planets. Beautifully made, a puzzle. This is 4,000 years old, but there's nothing precise about it. There's nothing accurate about it either, but it shows that humankind's mind was in the right place. It was saying, we've got metal, we can make it into intricate things. And this mood continued until, let's say, the middle of the 18th century, when John Harrison, the legendary clockmaker who Dava Sobel made so famous in her book, wonderful book,
right.
Longitude, made beautifully intricate clocks, but only one of each. And to be precise, you've got to learn the technique of making the same thing over and over again. I mean, I know this is a mantra of mine, which I'm saying over and over again, so I'm sort of a self-referential thing, but that needs to be achieved, and it wasn't achieved until May the 4th, 1776. And what happened then, if I can explain, is that James Watt, who everyone will know was the, quote, inventor of the steam engine, sure, he knew how to make these things, but they were very, very inefficient, and no work was achieved effectively because steam leaked all over the place. Because the way they made cylinders was to take a sheet of steel and hammer it until it formed a circle and then weld it together and then lower the piston into it. And the piston rocked around inside it like a pea in a drum. But then nearby, or well, 70 miles away from James Watt's workshop, was this remarkable lunatic called John Wilkinson, who was obsessed with metallic iron.
John Iron Mad Wilkinson.
You have it right, exactly. I mean, he had an iron desk and an iron table and an iron boat. He had an iron coffin in his workshop and sort of the jolly japes of the 18th century. He would lie in it. And when a comely maiden, this is before me too, presumably, came into his workshop, he would leap out of his coffin and surprise her. He's now buried in the same coffin now under an iron obelisk in North Wales. But he knew how to make cylinders properly. And he wanted James Watt to supply him with an engine, a steam engine, to make one of his drills work properly. And when Watt turned up with this thing, gosh, you know, steam going all over the place and barely able to move, Wilkinson said to Watt, "You don't know how to make a cylinder. Let me show you how to make a proper cylinder with the hole in it, you know, exactly the right dimension and the same dimension all across its length." And he did. And the important thing about it was that the tolerance, and this is the key to the structure of the book, the tolerance between the outer edge of the piston and the inner edge of the cylinder was the thickness of an English shilling, which is about a tenth of an inch. Mm. And when I realized that I could begin the book with things that were had a tolerance of a tenth of an inch, then the next chapter could be 0.001 of an inch and go on to 0.001. And you've got a narrative, and that's how the book was structured.
What fascinated me about Wilkinson, too, is that this precision that comes to help Watt basically comes out of working on cannons.
An awful lot of this story involves the military, both back then in the 18th century and today with what they call the dark side of the United States Air Force, doing all sorts of amazing research in fields like GPS and telescopes and, you know, sinister stuff. So yes, I mean, that was born out of the fact that Wilkinson had a contract with the Royal Navy to make cannons. And previously, cannons were made of sort of cast iron and they would break with dismaying frequency and sailors would be killed when attempting to fire cannonballs out of them. But he worked out how to drill into a block of iron to use a boring mechanism and produce holes that were straight and had the same diameter all along. The Navy was delighted. But much more delighted was James Watt, because once the first cylinder had been made on that famous May the 4th date, and suddenly his engine worked perfectly and there was no leaking steam and the power of this thing was just majestic. It's a chuff, 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 chuff. And suddenly everyone realized, my God, we can use the power of creating steam out of boiling water and really use all of that energy. We can do all sorts of things. I'm going to order, he said, 500 more. And so Wilkinson made, all to the same tolerance of one-tenth of an inch, 500 cylinders. And with that, the Industrial Revolution was off to the races and factories opened all over Britain. Cities were created in Liverpool, Manchester, Birmingham, London. Fortunes were made and the modern world began. So I think it's rather intriguing that we know the date when the modern world started.
You tell a story as a young boy, I think you're 10 years old, and your father brings home these metal blocks. And you realize precision at that point. And then, as you indicated earlier in our conversation about driving through Russia in a Rolls Royce, so Henry Royce plays quite a role in the story. So you get to, in many ways, kind of trace your own dealings with precision.
Yes, I mean, it's my father would bring, well, on this particular day, that it's just stayed in my mind 50, 60 years later. He brought these beautiful steel blocks back home at dinner time. Three of us were just sitting down to dinner. My father took out these two of the biggest of these blocks, which are called Joe blocks or gauge blocks, which people like my father would use to calibrate their micrometers. And he took two of the blocks out and laid them on the tablecloth. My mother had a complete conniption because she came from Belgium and she made lace, and this was a lace tablecloth, and my father's, everything he brought back from the factory was covered with machine oil and stuff. And anyway, so she left, gave a little cry and ran off to the sanctuary of the kitchen. And he showed me these blocks, and he showed me that they weren't magnetic by pushing them towards each other, and they didn't attract or repel each other. And then he put one on top of the other and said to me, "All right, young lad, take off the top block." And I lifted it up, and the bottom block came with it. And I thought, that's rather odd, because they're not magnetic. Mm. And so I held the bottom block with my right hand and the top block with my left, and once again tried to pull it off, and it wouldn't come. And I tried harder and harder, tried to force them apart. And my father said, "Stop, stop, you'll hurt yourself." And he said, "I can remove one from the other by sliding it. It's called ringing, sliding it. But you cannot pull them apart because they are so perfectly flat that the two surfaces actually molecularly bond one with the other, and the two pieces of metal for a few seconds become one." And that stuck in my mind, along with also when I picked up this Rolls Royce that you've just mentioned, when I drove across the Soviet Union in it. I was shown round the factory up in Crewe, where they hand make these, what were once anyway, beautiful handmade cars. And one of the engineers was showing me a crankshaft he had made, a huge piece of cast iron, you know, that makes the pistons go up and down. And it was beautifully polished with chamois leather. And he had said he'd been working on it for several days, filing and adjusting. And he showed me that if you put this crankshaft between two bearings and spin it, because no one side was even fractionally heavier than the other, because it was so perfectly balanced, it would spin in theory forever. I mean, friction would ultimately do it in, but those two things, perfect flatness and perfect balance, remained with me from my youth and childhood, indeed.
Simon Winchester is our guest. The name of the book is The Perfectionists: How Precision Engineers Created the Modern World. The book is published by Harper. Probably one of the most striking ways of learning about precision is in failures. And you write about a rather recent account of a Qantas airline flight in 2010 that this is a double-decker aircraft that explodes in the air. Tell us ultimately, I mean, our mind races as to what that can be, and then it comes down to the tiniest of things.
It was the port side number two engine, in other words, the inner of the two engines on the left-hand wing, made by Rolls-Royce. It was a Trent 900, one of the state-of-the-art engines. And on this particular flight, which is in, I think, November 2010, it was leaving Singapore en route for Sydney, 459 people on board. Engines spooled up to maximum power. These things were lifting this gigantic aircraft up to cruising altitude. Suddenly, huge explosion from the number two engine, and shrapnel went all over the place, puncturing the wing, the fuel tanks, the fuselage. Well, no one was hurt. In the end, the incredibly skillful Qantas crew, five pilots on board that day, managed to wrestle the plane back to Singapore. And they landed, the brakes weren't working, all sorts of things were wrong, but no one died. But when they investigated what had happened, it was a tiny pipe about the diameter of a drinking straw, which had been machined in a factory in Hucknall in northern England about a year before, but mismachined by a tiniest fraction of a millimetre, such that one of the walls of this drinking straw-sized oil stub, it was called a stub feed pipe, which sent lubricating oil to one of the bearings, had been just a tiny bit thinner than it should have been. And under the enormous stresses of this engine, it fractured. and spewed hot oil all over the rotor blade, which burst into flame and then caused the rotor blade to melt and throw off all the various bits and bobs, which then acted as shrapnel and made the engine explode. And one has to wonder, well, at least I certainly do in this book, whether in the quest for increasing power, increasing speed and all the rest of it, we are reaching the edges of the tolerance of, that we're able to create. I mean, can we, should human lives depend on a piece of metal being machined a hundredth of a millimetre too thin? Are we? And interestingly enough, and this has been topical, we learn that more troubles, not just for Rolls-Royce aero engines, but Pratt & Whitney as well, they've had to withdraw, I think, 383 engines from service. There are something like 30 aircraft in Seattle, at Boeing, in Savannah, I think it is, where they have in the southeast of the United States, and in Toulouse in France. Planes are waiting for engines. They can't be delivered because engineers can't make the engines. They can't guarantee the safety of the engines because of the inability to machine these tiny tolerances.
What is it about the fact that that plane operated correctly for 2 years before it happened? I mean, you talk about the thinning, so I assume that's a wearing away and then it fractures.
It's metal fatigue.
So how do you ever forecast that if you're going through the regular process of saying, well, this is correct, this is ready, this isn't ready, of being able to say, oh, okay, this may not work down the line?
Well, that's a very, very, very good question. The assumption is that if the machining is done correctly, and they do an immense amount of computer modeling of how, let's say, a pipe like this will stand up to the inevitable stresses of landings and takeoffs. But it's if it's mismachined, I mean, that was the problem, that one wall was thinner than it should have been, and that puts an exorbitant amount of stress on that one part of the tube. And so it becomes inevitable that it will fail if they recognize that it had been mismachined. And the problem was, it ultimately came down to human error, because every tube that goes out of this factory is rigorously checked and signed off on. But on this case, someone carelessly signed off on a tube which wasn't properly made.
If you have Boeing waiting, hurry up, hurry up.
You're absolutely right.
And this is ultimately what you leave us with in the book, which is this idea to think more about these objects that we take for granted, number one. And number two, what is that we actually have a stake in this?
We all have a stake in it. And I mean, moving into, I mean, I'm concerned about mechanical precision in this book. The engineers say, don't worry, we'll crack it. There are new materials coming online and new techniques of machining. But the same applies to electronic precision as well. I mean, look at how much we rely on, leaving privacy concerns and things like that. A simple thing like my iPhone here, the chip that, as it were, powers this iPhone,
right,
is about the size of my pinky finger nail. But it contains 4.3 billion transistors, not million, but billion, bearing in mind that the transistor, when it was invented in 1948 in New Jersey, was about the size of my fist. Well, they've made them so small. I mean, I think the most remarkable statistic that came to me when I was writing the book is that there are now more transistors in the world today than there are leaves on all the trees in all the world. I mean, when I drove here today, you drive through endless stands of forest and you think what an incalculable number of leaves there must be on those trees. But then think not just the Berkshires, not think of the Hudson Valley, but think of the world. But there are more transistors. But it is, Intel says it's true. They produce, or they and their cohort, produce 13 trillion transistors every single day. And they're getting so small and operating at such infinitesimal spaces between one transistor and another, that they're operating in the realm of quantum mechanics, where things behave in a very peculiar way. And one has to ask, in the same way that we asked with this tiny tube in the jet engine, whether in the electronic world also we're starting to deal in figures in tolerances which are so tiny, we're not even quite sure how things will behave now or in the future. But they all say, oh, don't worry, we'll solve this problem. And I wonder if they will.
It is a fascinating way to leave a fascinating conversation. The name of the book is The Perfectionists: How Precision Engineers Created the Modern World. Simon Winchester, it's always a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Good to see you, Jay. Thank you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.